You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Rick Potts. Welcome, Rick. It's good to have you on the show.
We're with you and the audience, Eric. Thanks very much.
And so, Rick, you are one of the guests who is a visitor to Tompkins County who has brought something significant to the region. And I try to use this show to introduce people of the region to themselves and to outsiders who are have an impact on our life. And you have helped to bring the Smithsonian's Exploring Human Origins, What Does It Mean to Be Human? Show to the library and also with the Museum of the Earth. So that's the context. But what I want to do to start with is to just do the show as I normally do it, which is, who are you? What do we need to know about you in order to start this conversation so that we can get to know each other and to model that getting to know each other to our audience?
Right, right. Well, I think that everyone needs to create a story about themselves to help create continuity. And for me, as with so many other people, it begins with family. Mm-hmm. I grew up just outside of Philadelphia on the East Coast. Come from a small family, two loving parents, a fantastically caring older brother. That older brother, I think, was a born teacher, and is a born teacher. He would always like to, I always wanted to go out and play baseball or football or whatever, do some rough and tumble things when I became of age to do that with him. But he would always say, well, let me tell you what I learned today about the origin of the solar system or this or that aspect of science. And so I'd sit there but by virtue of that, I became very interested in the origin of things. With my father, he was a singer, professional singer in Philadelphia, gained a great deal of interest in music and in choral singing. He and my mother told a lot of stories about when he was away in World War II, the stories of that strife of them being apart from one another led to me during the Vietnam era, when I had a low draft number, but even before I had a draft number at all, I became a conscientious objector. I applied for that, and that led me to write essays. While, doctors were saying, oh, listen, I can get you out of this, I said, no, I don't want to do it that way. I want to, fulfill the obligations to myself of my conscience.
Right, and also the obligation to serve.
And the obligation to serve and to understand all of that whole tableau of what was going on, not just in my life, but across the world at that time in the very late 60s and early 70s, earliest 70s. And so I grew up in a church, a Protestant church. I like to tell my friends that I grew up Protestant with emphasis on the protest part of the word. I always felt that explorations of faith were ones that also had an obligation to question, and thus to better understand one's place in the world and relationships. In college, that was a eye-opening experience in terms of the diversity of the world. Although I went locally, I was at Temple University, mm-hmm. right in Center City, Philadelphia. But I studied anthropology, which I knew I wanted to do in high school. But I also studied, took courses in comparative religion and on trying to understand the variety of ways by which, people wrap their minds around their worlds and the meaningfulness of their place in the world. And so I think a combination of those sorts of things really, helped to give at least the background to who I am.
Uh-huh. That's now, can you, as you bring the picture to now, how would you give us in a few sentences who you are now?
Yes, Well, I would say that I would define myself in terms of my values, and a lot of those do come from not only what I perceived of myself and others perceived of me, mm-hmm. and as I was growing up, things, you know, I remember very early on when I was a little kid, my mother saying to me something like, "You really want people to be kind, don't you?" And it was kind of like she was amazed at that.
And, you expect it and you insist on it.
I insist on it. I do insist on that. And so I do have a very strong value about, I guess I would call it inclusiveness, the inclusive nature of who we are as human beings, the inclusiveness of life. And I think that my own studies in anthropology, and particularly paleoanthropology, and studying fossil humans and evolution, helped to ensconce our sense of the oneness of humanity and the oneness of life in one form of a larger context, a sense of kinship. And I do look for not the relativist, but the universalist aspects of things, the commonality of who people are, and also when I think in terms of my religious upbringing and explorations, the commonality of what is sacred and meaningful through the world's traditions, religious traditions, mm-hmm. and so those are some of the things that really that I care about, today, and that is been really I've been very lucky to be able to explore that and to express that those qualities, those values that I hold deeply. In my international travels, I've spent during my adult life about a quarter of it in Africa or Africa and elsewhere, digging in the ground, finding fossils and stone tools and things that help us put together the story of our ancient prehistory. And I think that when I first got into anthropology, I wanted to see the world in a physical sense, the beauty of landscapes the different organisms, plants and organisms and animals of the world. But I think one of the ways in which I'm a little bit different now is that people initially or superficially different from myself have far and away become the heartbeat of my life. Mm-hmm. When I go to China and I do field work there, I've spent sometimes 5 weeks in almost total linguistic isolation where I'm not, even thinking in a language, it seems to me, but I'm thinking about the science, I'm thinking through translators. Or when I'm in southern Kenya, where I've spent more than 32 years, digging in the ground, I'm in the middle of the country of the famous Maasai people of East Africa, some of the quintessential people of East Africa in the popular imagination, and at first there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of commonality there, but through one area of commonality is humor. And another one is just being able to sit down and look each other in the face and speak in some kind of broken English or whatever, Swahili or whatever, to find the commonalities, and those always arise.
Yes, and we're going to come back to this theme of commonalities and how it works. But let's cut to music. You brought some music with you, or you told me that there was some music you'd like to play, and one of them is a piece called Africa. Do you want to introduce it?
Sure. Yeah, Africa is a piece of shape note music that was composed by the early American colonial composer William Billings, and to the lyrics of famous lyricist at that time and hymn writer Isaac Watts, It's even though Africa is an arbitrary name to the piece, the shape note music was given, or pretty much given arbitrary names. This one happens to be Africa. And as I think I mentioned to you, it's not because that it's where I've ended up spending a quarter of my adult life, but it's a piece that I think is quintessential to the exuberance of my life, and it has a very rustic quality to it when sung correctly, and kind of a spontaneous nature to the music, and to me it reflects a place where, within a sacred song, where questions are asked, and I think that that is reflecting of what I described before as the protest part of faith, the part that wants to question and therefore to deepen one's understanding of one's own faith and the sense of the sacred and the divinity. Other than that, it's just something I really enjoy singing.
Yes, and shape note music is, if I'm not mistaken, is quintessentially American religious folk music.
Yes, that's correct. That's a great way to describe it.
And it's the militant statement that we are here to make our lives. We may not have great education or great erudite, urbane, cosmopolitan skills of Europe, but we have and we document and we sing well, and we sing a cappella.
Yes, exactly right. And we sing together with voices that diverge from one another, come back together. There's, for Africa itself, there's this kind of almost tumbling waterfall quality to it that I really, really appreciate.
And the height of shape note music's popularity in the American culture was also the height of openness and welcomeness before we became fearful of Catholics and fearful of Jews. When leaders would welcome Muslims or what they called Mohammedans and Buddhists and Hindus and Jews and free thinkers and socialists to American soil, which was in that first part of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm. That's
a window that we've lost track of in the current polarities that we live.
I agree with that. Yes, thanks very much, Eric.
Here we go, Africa.
God.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Rick Potts. Rick, I want to point out a line from that song, if you'll allow me.
Sure.
Why do we indulge fears, suspicion hates? And that seems to be a question that drives at our incapacity to appreciate what's in front of our faces and not fear it.
Yeah, that is exactly the verse. You've nailed it as far as I'm concerned, Eric. That is the verse that always comes back to me when I think about that particular Shape Note song.
Right.
The second part of that verse, as I understand it, as I recall, also then, you know, ask the almost rhetorical question that, how long will God stand for this? when will God grow weary of these sorts of complaints and fears and even of the saints? It speaks to a kind of humility that we need to take into life in relationship with other people, because it's often other people that that often will generate the most in terms of our fears and our suspicions.
Right, right, and that actually, the next verse resolves itself in the concept of something we cannot comprehend, which is an everlasting love, which is not the sentimental love that we've come to know through what was a later period of romanticism, but the quality of acceptance and place. You know, the meaning of salvation is to have a place, to not be denied a place, to not be denied standing or value. And this form of music that you have brought is essentially what would be the white version of spirituals.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
And there's a strong
connection.
And we don't know that because we have, in some sense, as a culture, alienated ourselves from that quality of There's discipline in singing this way, but there's tremendous spontaneity. And there's also improvisation. And the family that I grew up in, we would sing conversation to each other, which was an ancient form of working, which is not unlike the African-American spiritual tradition, but we would create the dialogue as we worked. And that is also an ancient tradition that we don't know.
Yeah, I agree with that.
We forget the depth of our past. But what I want to ask you now is, What are the experiences that have helped you to both, when you say you've seen the commonality of people, and that is what you strive to see, but the shadow side of that value is the utter and incomparable absolute uniqueness of each tradition and each person that cannot be subsumed into what's common. But as we appreciate each extreme, we grow deeper. What have you experienced? How has this been driven home, or how does this reside in your life? How have you learned to appreciate the commonality through the difference?
Well, I think that this is the essential problem of and opportunity for the field of study that I've devoted to. A field of study doesn't even give credit to the depth of what it means to me, but anthropology, the study of humans, but again, it's more than a study. It's an experience. It's a participation in being human.
Mm-hmm.
But the field of study has happened to allow me great luck and fortune to travel, to see other people. As I said earlier, people who are different from myself, becoming seeing the commonalities that It's not a transformation. It still honors the diversity and the difference.
Right. And the question that I'm asking is, how have you had to hold on to your particularity with such humility that it would almost be to deny it in order to recognize
yeah.
the commonality?
Yeah, I think that I think that's, you know, the idea of things coming full circle is a helpful model or analogy here.
Where in your life has that come full circle? I'm trying to find out what the interior experience was, not the observed exterior experience, but what was the interior experience as you have learned to value that deep commonality and to still hold that diversity?
Yeah, I think within myself, it gets back to this this inherent value that somehow I grew up with, that does link kindness and inquisitiveness, and the sense of being inclusive. So, for example, again, this is an experiential story, but I think it illustrates the internal process. It was early on in my career, digging away in on a very hot day in southern Kenya in the Great Rift Valley there, and I hear as I'm just digging by myself, finding some stone tools and some bits and pieces of fossil bone, and I hear the ding de-ling de-ling of goats approaching, and I turn around as they get closer, and there is this this little boy and this little girl, they Maasai kids, who live in the area, they look like they were about 3.5 feet tall. I mean, they were so small. They may have been about 5 years old, and they were out there by the two of them by themselves, herding goats. And they just came and they sat down. They made the first move, the first move was to touch my skin on my arm, because they hadn't seen an arm that had as much obvious hair on it before in their lives. And it was pretty clear that I was the first white person they had seen. And they were just giggling to themselves touching the hair on my arm. And then I just thought, well, let me just offer them my sunglasses and show them that, what sunglasses can do. And they just loved trying them on, and they were just, giggling. We just spent 5 minutes together, or 10 minutes together, and they had no idea about why I was out there. They must have thought I was crazy, just digging in the hot sun in the dirt. For nothing, and they were doing the important work of herding cows. They just, hugged me at the end. And I hugged them back, of course. And there was just this, almost like tears coming down my face at this, what seemed to me to be the quintessence of the internal process that I go through of just being with, of just communicating in whatever way you can, right, with people who, first time they'd ever seen a white person, first time I'd ever sat with Maasai kids, and
bringing
that
all your
process.
Baggage of kids.
And, yeah, that's right. Bringing it all together, but in some ways, you go through this process that does make a full circle from, here I am in a foreign situation. I don't have any way of communicating in the regular way I normally would with words, but we found a way to reach to the commonness of that humanity.
Uh-huh. That's a beautiful story. And
I have another story.
Sure. Yeah,
I have another story that actually reflects this shape note one, and I just want to tell it very quickly.
Sure.
I was much later in life, in other words, just a couple of years ago, I was asked to visit Charleston, South Carolina, to give several days of lectures during Darwin Week. Darwin Week in February, the week of commemorating Charles Darwin's birth. And we actually had a session there, which I was very pleased about, where I gave a short presentation about human evolution. And there were a pastor and a rabbi and an imam who and some representatives from other faith groups in the area who gave a reflection upon what I had to do to talk about. Well, at the end of all of that, and it went, you know, it was very, very interesting kind of perspectives that were shared. But at the end of it, there were three people who actually did attend a church where this was occurring, and they came up to me and they were very aggravated and thought that I was just a false person because I was talking about evolution. And, I just said, wanted to say, well, could you tell me more? And I wanted to listen. And they mentioned somehow something about singing. And I said, well, I'm a singer too. In fact, this particular night, I'm missing a rehearsal of one of my favorite forms of music, shape note music. And they stopped for a moment. They said, you sing shape note?
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, yeah. And they went off a few yards away, and they formed three quarters of a square. And they said, well, come on. And I said, well, what do you mean? And they said, come on, why don't you sing with us? And I said, okay, and because I had been practicing, I named a number. All the shape note songs have a number given to them in the various books. And I said, well, how about 455, which happened to be a shape note song called Soar Away, which they knew. And it was horrible the way we were singing it. I mean, it's just really not very good at all, but it was a shared experience. And it's kind of like, well, the rest of the time with them, it was just talking about shape note music.
Uh-huh.
And, after a few minutes, my host, called me away, signaled that I had to go off to dinner. And I said, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to go off, but it's been really nice talking with you. And they said, well, okay, bye. And then as I was leaving, one of them said, oh, by the way, you sing good for an evolutionist. And, the differences, the division still existed, but we had found some common ground.
Right.
And that, to me, is, that is success in life.
Yeah. No, that is beautiful. That is beautiful. I'm going to do the station ID. You think about what next song to go to next, and then tell me. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Rick Potts. So, Rick, what should we play next?
Well, why don't we go to the Beethoven, the Choral Symphony.
Okie doke, here we go.
Thank you.
In the WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Rick Potts. So, Rick, I want to pursue some conversation on the nature of anthropology, and I have background in two different forms of anthropology, which don't really recognize each other, which is kind of sad. It's part of the reflection of the problem we have in our culture now. One is cultural and biological anthropology through a secular university at Cornell, and the other one is through anthropology as a religious or theological study. I don't know if you're familiar, but anthropology is the study of what it means to be human in relationship to a reality much larger than one's humanity. Whether that's God or not God, but it's what is the nature and what are the limits and possibilities of being human, as a matter of meaning and action and agenda. Whereas anthropology as a cultural and biological system is more, it gets at the meaning, but it demands material evidence. It demands witnessing particular ceremonies or actions or particular processes, and it doesn't respect the individual experience the way anthropology as a religious discipline does. Where an individual's testimony about one's own experience has the weight of evidence. And that's not true necessarily in a more of a cultural or biological anthropology, because it's something that needs to be verified, needs to be worked on by others. And this is kind of a tension in our times. The two practices serve different ends, and sometimes we seem to get lost in conflict, and this is kind of the science and religion challenge playing itself out. And I'm just wondering, what are your thoughts about what's really at bottom going on in this conflict?
Yeah, I'm not sure that I accept all of the description of the how you put it. I think that
frame it in a way that works for you.
Yeah, well, it's just that my experience with cultural anthropologists, not that I am one, but there are many who I've spoken with, often, you know, do look to individuals for an understanding of what cultural understandings, precepts, you know, values, codes, and so on. I do agree that the cultural anthropological mission, in a sense, is to then try to generalize enough in order to understand or to categorize almost the nature of particular groups of people.
Right.
I think that we're moving away, though. Yeah.
Can I just say what you've just said is that in my terms, and I think we're saying the same thing, is that anthropologists use individual humans as data sources.
Mm-hmm.
But not necessarily as artists of their own reality.
Mm-hmm.
And we're doing, anthropologists are doing that more and more now as we become more attuned to that. But that is
right.
That is the life of religious faith. This is William James' varieties of religious experience. He took individual experience seriously as something to be honored and only questioned to a point. Because you couldn't reproduce it. You cannot reproduce an individual's experience.
Right.
It's just impossible. Right. So it's not valid by the terms of science. And many anthropologists wish to honor that for good reason. But much of our own lives are much, much more amenable to the non-reproducible dimensions that are embodied in spiritual and religious traditions and cultural traditions that are completely lived by individuals. It's attention.
Right, yeah.
I once did a study of advisor-advisee relationships in the anthropology department at Cornell. I was a sophomore, and I got to do this because we didn't have to do pass those institutional review boards. This was 40 years ago, and I found that in the first years there was tremendous dissatisfaction between the students, and their advisors, and in the middle years when they were graduating from the program and going on to graduate school, they were just hanging tight with their advisors. And by the time they were finishing up, they were so fed up with their advisors, and their advisors were fed up with them. It was just a perfect bell curve. But it was really hard for the department to accept that one of us could study ourselves, especially as a junior person. And that level of critical reflection has been something that is part of religious life and transparent reflection in an open religious community. But it's been really hard to get at in the anthropology or the scientific community from my experience.
Well, that's a very interesting analysis, Eric, and it may help me, in a sense, understand why a particular view of culture and individuality sometimes falls on deaf ears. And that particular view is that while the concept of culture in a social sense is one of the contributions of anthropology to intellectual discourse in the West, that my own particular view is that every person comes from a different culture. And to my mind, that's where I bring individuality and culture together. In other words, what I'm talking about is that as we grow up, as we explore and express our own humanity in all of its crazy diversity, that each individual is doing a heck of a lot of editing of all of the possible things that come at them in terms of ideas, in terms of behaviors,
editing,
in terms
filtering,
of right. Filtering, yes, editing, filtering, whatever you want to call it, and that individual experience also, helps us understand how that the concept of personality, for example, in psychology, and culture and individuality actually can all maybe merge into one kind of thing, explaining why brothers within a family or siblings, let's say, within a family, can grow up with almost all the same kind of experiences, and yet they become very different people. And that's because they're doing a variety of different sorts of editing that is almost tantamount to what we think of as different cultures. And there can be just as much foreignness that exists close at hand that can exist even from, across people from very different parts of the world, in my view. And so the concept of culture and anthropology as a social sense really comes from the fact that historically anthropologists have studied culture or cultures in as largely as isolated entities. In other words, people who were more distant from the rest of the world, and thus came up with this concept of culture that may not be that valid because it does not recognize the individuality.
Right, and it also it grew up in an outside outside of modernity, and yet anthropologists are studying cultures that are modern, increasingly,
yes. Yes.
And having to go through exactly what you're talking about. Well, what the question that this is leading to is, and this is something maybe you can help me understand. You are very open to working with the material artifacts of religious culture, be it music or art or whatever. And I'm assuming that that also applies to texts, but we haven't really talked about that. And what I have noticed is that people who are profoundly religious in practice and reflective and self-critical are much more likely to be fluent or at least conversational in the practices of science, whereas those who are at an equal level of mature practice in science are not familiar and not fluent in the practices of analyzing religious texts or doing the kind of critical self-reflection in terms of using the tools of any tradition. And that just it seems like a lost opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That may well be, and I'm sure that reflects the sample of people who you've met. I've been fortunate enough to be with anthropologists and other scholars, including scientists, I guess we all just pick our friends.
Some are friends and some are not friends. Actually, part of the discipline of living in this way is being sure to not reject somebody.
Right.
And to question that. Every experience that we have as a human comes with a positive or negative spin, even before we realize it. And then realizing it, how do you counter it? That's the level of question that I'm asking here.
Yeah, well, I guess one way that I can reflect upon your question, I don't know if it answers it, but it is my own personal reflection on it at this moment, is with regard to the question of what I study, which is one that raises a lot of concerns and issues, and has been a very cantankerous bar in public education, and that's the question of evolution, and particularly
right.
human evolution.
Right.
There, what I find is that we have in our society this enduring idea that the conflict there is between science and religion. And that's not really what I find at all.
Nor do I.
And this in our tour around the country, including the tour that included Ithaca when we came there for the library tour of our Human Origins exhibit. What we find in our conversations with clergy and with in our community conversations, or kind of our town hall meetings that we hold in every location, is that it's not a science versus religion divide, but rather that people who are practicing scientists have a whole variety of different relationships with religion, and people who are have deep religious insights and commitments and are actually clergy, have gone into it as a profession, have a whole variety of relationships with the science. And that can include a total, not only embracing, but, wow, the concept of evolution, the very, understanding and knowledge of it deepens their faith to others who say that are on a very opposite end of the spectrum, that no, it totally challenges everything that I can possibly think of in my religious faith. It's not a clear-cut divide in my view. And you'll get people of different parts on that spectrum in both the scientific scholarly realm as well as the religious faith realm.
And I think for just practical matters, and this is to speed the conversation along because I don't want to get lost in a certain certain trap. What I'm going to suggest is that science and evolution are the best we have of the material record of what happened in a material way. And we can make inferences to some extent about what some of those behaviors and fossils mean and what the meaning of life was for individuals. But that's really a purpose that's addressed much more clearly by religion and the data that religion uses in analyzing what is worth it and what's not worth it, what's good and what's not good. And what I've found is that looking at non-scientific texts is something that many scientists are just reluctant to do, especially in this area. Whereas looking at the evolutionary record is something religious people are more likely to do. And I'm just wondering why is there that divide about not taking each other's standards of evidence seriously and stories and ways of analyzing material seriously? Because I'm feeling, and this may not be true, but my sense is that the scientific community is much less not fluent, but not even proficient in the language of analyzing meaning, particularly from religious texts or cultural traditions. Why is this?
It's interesting. I think it depends upon the context in which scientists speak with one another and how they talk about science. Sometimes as we've gone around the country, we get people saying, "Oh, you know, the science is just you treat it as if it's just another religion," and you know that to me is very, very foreign, and that's very, very foreign, and it's not true. Yeah. It's a methodological thing. It is very limited in terms of what it attempts to say in terms of any kind of meaning or ultimate meaning.
It's extraordinarily useful and limited.
But it's useful in being limited. Exactly,
yeah.
Right. And it's it limits itself to explanations that are naturalistic and that are empirically can be explored in an empirical way. And so when talking within the framework of science, scientists, I think, often are so embedded in that methodological limitation that when asked to speak to questions of meaning, they may be a little bit hampered with regard to that. And so I think that may be part of the answer to it, regardless of that.
And I think
that we really get into trouble when, you know, either scientists or people of that are coming from a religious perspective basically demand a standard of truth which the other has got to embrace or they're dismissed.
Right.
And that's the real, real problem there. And so it's a question of how do we, you know, respect the meaning making of religion, and there is no just one religion. There are a whole variety of different, of course, ways of doing that. And then how can there be respect for the limited but very useful methodology of science and what it finds? And how it can help us to sometimes have to give up cherished notions within science and cherished notions of what we thought about the world.
Right, and this is where you're actually walking up to a really... I think many times religious people, when they're trying to discuss, particularly conservative religious folks, when they're discussing evolution, when they perceive science as a threat to religion, they become more dug in particular religious interpretations than the texts will bear. But they're dug in because they feel defensive. In the same way that scientists among themselves can't appear to tolerate anything that's not scientific.
Yeah, I think that part of the difficulty here, Eric, is that scientists as well as people of deep religious conviction sometimes can feel like victims. And the scientists do, because, you know, we keep hearing all the time about, well, how many states there is legislation that is being pushed by for religious reasons, we are told, to basically prevent the teaching of evolution in schools. Right. And so scientists get defensive about that. They feel like they're victims. And then you also have people who are basically saying, in this world of modernity, I can't express my religiosity. I can't express my religious convictions, the things that are very part of my very identity. Also is difficult.
Right, but the thing is, in the schools, this is really, we can teach religious practice in a very both religious anthropological and cultural anthropological way in the public schools. There's nothing prohibiting that.
That's right.
We can also teach science. And my experience has been was when we do both well in a public school, the parents, the students, and even the faculty who are very scared at the outset of this are happy with the outcome because everybody's needs gets met.
I completely agree with that approach. And in fact, I think that one of the ways that we're trying to work with teachers around the country, when I say we in the Human Origins program at the Smithsonian, is to try to not avoid the so-called elephant in the room with regard to teaching evolution, which is that people are coming into any situation with very, very strong and important, religious convictions and insights into the world that cannot be ignored and cannot be dismissed. And so there's got to be room somewhere for it all.
Right. And as you teach natural systems, and as you teach evidence in a science-based way, to also teach different religious traditions and how they handle evidence for the meaning of life. And what's good and what's not good, what's worthwhile and not worthwhile, and teach that separately. Now, scientists aren't qualified to teach that, and you have to have different people to teach that. But we need to invest in both. And my hope is that as you open this conversation, you will be able to invite, or people will see the opportunity to seize the teaching of multiple religions, and also to have people bring their parents and grandparents and neighborhoods into the classroom to explain what it is of value to them and why.
Yeah, I think this is what you're saying is second nature to me, because I was very fortunate to go to a school system, including a high school, that exactly followed the model you're talking about.
Yeah, and I didn't go to that model, but I lived in a community that modeled that kind of behavior.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We're coming down to the end of the hour, and I want to close the show out with a conversation about what you do to take care of yourself.
Sure.
How do you take care of yourself intellectually, emotionally, physically, on a daily, weekly, monthly, yearly, whenever basis? And how do you know you need to take care of yourself?
Right. Yeah. Well, how I know that I need to is largely a matter of, well, how much energy do I have today? And so there are two things that really come to mind. One is when I'm here in the United States, here at home, that I do sacred music singing, and that may become pretty apparent from the musical selections that I've made. And you know, that to me is really important. It's important physically, that aspect of correct breathing, that aspect. It's important socially, because my voice was definitely not made to be heard just by itself, but in a group of people. The choral, the cooperative, and the wonderful whole is greater than the sum of its parts, so important to me. And just again, the exuberance of the sound to the thoughtfulness and reflective nature that can occur in other songs is all very important. The second part of it has to do with the fact that I have chosen to live a life that is completely schizophrenic. In other words, I can sit in an office and answer email on the phone and to contemplate and write my publications, analyze data on the one hand, and yet I can go out to Africa or to other parts of the world and spend an entire day walking 5 miles looking for fossils or stone tools, sweating in the hot sun. I live in a tent for 2 to 3 months a year, usually on the edge of a cliff in the Rift Valley of Africa, and that combination to me is spectacular.
Yeah, yeah. You live in across the extremes.
Yep.
Yeah. And you can call it schizophrenic, but I would call it paradoxical or contradictory or hypocritical on some levels, you know, depending upon what lens you want to analyze it with. Because
mm-hmm.
all of those words apply, and it's useful to be able to identify the ways in which we have to do the opposite in order to bring ourselves into balance.
It's kind of a metaphor for the conversation and the things that we've spoken about here is how do you bring things that seem to be initially in opposition into a unity?
Yes, yes. One of the most important lessons for me from seminary was a lesson which also had to do with physiology. The body without tension is a corpse until rigor sets in. And we want to. Every muscle works because it's in opposition with something else. But they work because that's how we're made.
Mm-hmm.
And
excellent.
Rick, it's been fun debating back and forth with you and talking and just hanging in there with these issues and chatting about things like shape note music, which I rarely get a chance to talk about. what do you want to close the show with? What musically are we going to close here with?
Yeah, well, let's close with one that may be foreign to most listeners. It's a piece in the Georgian language called Shenkar, which is it means you are a vineyard. It comes from a liturgy written by the famous, at least in the country of Georgia, the Republic of Georgia, the famous composer Paleishvili. It is just such a beautiful piece. I hum it all the time. And the part at the end where it just grows in intensity basically says, may God adorn you. No one is more worthy of praise. And you yourself are the sun, brilliantly shining. And I kind of feel that every time I think of that last part there, I just want to say that to every child on earth.
Yes. And meet them just like you met the child while you were, the two children while you were digging.
Exactly.
Thank you, Rick. It's been
wonderful. Thank you very
much,
Eric. Well, really been a special pleasure for me, too.
Thank you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and that concludes the Made of Clay Report. And if you missed a portion of the show or you want to hear any one of 350 hours of interviews with local residents and visitors to this area, go to madeofclay.org. Thank you.